could tell she was no child, so there was nothing sinister going on. And how much older was I at 19 anyway? I think I might have actually drooled watching her walk to the van, and she could tell. My eyes were lit up like Times Square. "You like me, right?" she said. "Yeah," I nearly shouted, I was so excited. "How much would you charge me to have, you know, full sex?" "This is $50," she said. "You want sex and blowjob? It's $75. "Fine," I said. "I brought cash with me. I have it right here." I didn't care for 1 minute that $75 was easily half of my net worth in life, probably more. And the virginity thing was still a concern, but her beauty transcended my mission. I just had to fuck this girl. She was that hot. The only conceivable problem was whether or not she'd do it in the handicapped van. "We don't have to go anywhere, you know," I said, trying to make the back of my dad's van sound like a 4-star hotel. "We can do it right here and back. It's very comfortable." The language barrier was a problem because, unlike her sister, Mary barely spoke English. She looked at me, looked in the back, and then just looked hesitant. I gestured to the low-budget bed made of sleeping bags that I'd put together. "We will stay right in here," I said, louder and slower, like idiots do when they talk to foreign people. And then I tried to reassure her, "Don't be nervous, everything will be okay." At this point, I was praying to God that Telemundo had never aired Silence of the Lambs. "I will not drive to any remote place where I could kill you or anything. We could park at maybe the diner, the Camelot Diner, down the road," I pointed. "Camelo," she said. "Okay, Camelo." "I fuck you in van," I said. "Is okay? I bang you in truck?" "No one around at Camelot. I fuck you in truck, okay?" "Okay," she said, "fucking truck, Camelo." Let me tell you, arranging for paid sex is both more humiliating and ultimately more rewarding when you have to think, speak, and hand gesture your intentions as slowly as if you're a retard. You really feel like you've earned something when you finally get it. As a matter of fact, there would be fewer misunderstandings in marriage if negotiations like that took place right at the altar. The priest could take care of it. Just before the vows, he could say something like, "Miss, do you understand that you are offering to blow and fuck him for a period of at least 1 year?" "Yes." "Sir, do you understand that she's offering to blow and fuck you for a period of 1 year, and it will cost you a house in the suburbs, a minivan, and a Honda Civic?" "Yes." "Do you also understand that in exchange for her blowing and fucking you, you must agree to work nonstop and listen to her bitch every 5 seconds?" "Yes." "Do you also understand that after a period of 1 year, further blowing and fucking will cost you one necklace per year?" "Yes." "And do you also understand that over the next several years you are required to give her 2 or 3 children that will cost you $100,000 a child?" "Yes." "And you also understand that after a period of several years, the fucking and sucking will cease, but this arrangement will still cost you 80% of your worth?" "I do." "You may kiss the bride." It's depressing, yes, but God knows it's the fucking truth. Anyway, when we arrived at the Camelot Diner, which is still there, by the way, but it's now called the Tropicana, I found an appropriately quiet spot in the back by the dumpster. This wasn't some big parking lot. People were definitely going to be driving by pretty close to us, but no one was going to think anyone was in the van, so it would probably be okay. There were homes right there, too, because Elizabeth is basically the inner city, so if someone looked out of their window at the right angle, they might see something. I didn't care. I locked the doors, and then I figured I'd better be straight with her. "Me," I said, pointing at myself, "first time." "Huh?" she said. "First time," I said. "Now first time." I then used the universal sign for banging, which is putting your finger through a hole you make with the index finger and thumb on your other hand. She smiled at me, just coy and adorable. "Lo sé," she said. "I know this." "Really?" I said. "You know. How?" "Lo sé." I was nervous as hell. I'd been obsessed with getting to this point and getting laid, not even by a girl as hot. And now all I could do was stall. I tried my best to make small talk, as if she actually understood or cared about one word I was saying. Like her sister, Mary was really good at what she did for a living, because after a few minutes, she ignored me altogether and just handled the situation. "Dinero," she said, "what you want?" "I would like the deluxe, please," I said, like an idiot. "The intercourse with the blowjob on the side." "The what?" she said. I don't know if I said it because I'd seen it in some shitty teen sex movie, or just because we were at a diner where my favorite meal was a cheeseburger deluxe. In any event, she took the money and counted it, and that seemed to get the message across. "You want fuck and blowjob?" "Yes, I do," I said. In hindsight, I should have asked her for some French fries, too, and really tried to confuse the foreign cunt. So, you like New Jersey? After another painful minute or two of trying to make conversation, this girl just leaned over and started kissing me on the lips, which unbeknownst to me was a real treat. As I got older and more experienced with whores, I learned that kissing was not something they did regularly. It was too intimate. Of course, anyone who saw a pretty woman could tell you that too. That's about the only realistic detail in that film, as far as L.A. street hookers go. If you don't believe me, ask Hugh Grant. At 19, I was thin, and I wasn't bad-looking. I'd probably have had a shot at Mary since I wasn't yet grotesque, as I am now. I swear to Christ, when I was younger, I really was kind of a good-looking guy. Then one day in the mid-90s, I woke up, and I'd become Vic Tayback. The honest truth is, I thought she was attracted to me. I thought this was like the best date I'd ever had and maybe the start of a relationship. You tend to lose your ability to reason clearly when an incredibly hot woman puts the moves on you, whether you're paying her or not. But I realized that her attraction to me might not be all that strong when I noticed that she'd stop kissing me until, much like her sister, I put the $75 in her shoe. I swear to God, I should have paid these broads extra to fuck me with no shoes on just to see where they'd put the money. Once business was settled, we moved into the rear lounge. We sprawled out on the luxurious sleeping bags, and she took out a rubber. She put it on me with her mouth, which a lot of whores have done to me since. That's such a skill. I suggest that whores everywhere make it a permanent part of their routine. Whores who know how to do it right, please teach your friend whores. We started rolling around. Her long jet black hair was loose. She got naked, and then I got on top of her. And because I was a complete and utter novice, it took me a little while to find the proper hole. I didn't need a guide in, though. I did get it on my own. And once I was in there, I've got to tell you, I lasted probably a good minute and a half, which is way longer than a lot of other people have told me they lasted when they lost their virginity. I can be straight about this. My manly staying power wasn't due to my ironclad concentration or some kind of tantric sex self-hypnosis I learned about from Sting. It was strictly the awkwardness of the situation. Because I was preoccupied with the fact that we were fucking in my father's handicapped van, I can clearly remember my schizophrenic train of thought as I was banging her. It seesawed between, I can't believe I'm fucking a chick this hot, and Jesus, look at those tits, to, I'd better not leave any stains back here, and is tomorrow when I have to drive Pop to the rehabilitation center? I was somehow in the situation and watching it from a distance at the same time. I was happy to be having sex, but where I was doing it was at once funny and unbelievably depressing. I never shared this story with my father before he died, and sometimes when I recall it, I think I should have, because he probably would have found it hilarious. Let me tell you, once I was finished banging Mary, that same delusion that hit when she started kissing me returned, twice as bad. I suddenly felt such a connection to this girl that if I thought she understood more than every third word I said, I'd have told her all of my hopes and dreams and asked her to be my wife. Instead, we sat in silence for a while and sort of cuddled. It was the most intimate moment I'd ever shared with a woman. Then she started giving me kind of a hand job, which got me hard again. Then she blew me without a rubber on. I now know that no matter what you're paying, this is very, very rare for a hooker. In my mind, at that moment, she was no longer a hooker. She was a girl who clearly liked me. She was really into it, I thought. She was probably acting, but it sounded to me like I might have even satisfied her on some level. I was so happy with the way my first time went. It was a milestone, like the first time I was asked to appear on Letterman or when I played Carnegie Hall. I felt such an instant bond to this girl that I considered offering to help her study for her SATs. I'm sure someone of her background would have been impressed with my combined score of 860. Look, I said to her, is it okay if we do this again? See, she said, see, is okay, I like you. Then she gave me a kiss on the cheek. That did nothing to help me stay focused on the reality of the situation. After I dropped her off, I went straight back to the Camelot Diner and ordered a bacon, egg, and cheese on a hard roll with large chocolate milk. I have eaten that delicious, nutritious meal many times since, but it never came close to tasting as good as it did then. This was back when people were civilized and you were allowed to smoke inside, so afterward I lit up a cigarette. God, was that fantastic. As my friend Dan the Song Parody Man says, a cigarette after dinner is one of the 40 best cigarettes of the day. About a week later, I called Mary again. I had somehow gotten together the necessary $75, and the same exact scenario happened once again, including my meal afterward at the Camelot. And that wasn't the last time either, because she and I had a thing going. It was more drawn out each time we got together. We spent more time talking, and I got to know her a little. She told me that she and her sister were in the country illegally, which gave her an edge that I found incredibly sexy. There was no doubt about it. I was really smitten. I just thought she was a doll. She was adorable, and I liked her personality. So I tried to talk to her about how we could get her a green card to stay in the country. I didn't care if I had to keep paying her for our dates. I wanted this girl to be my girlfriend. My friends might take some work, but I figured I could easily bullshit my mom about it. There's no rule that you have to tell your mother that your girlfriend is a whore. Besides, this chick was young. She didn't look haggard. She didn't look like she'd done the rope and bungee cord bit at bachelor parties yet, that's for sure. I started thinking of how our relationship could develop, which was completely crazy. I concluded that the best thing to do was just dive in. I seriously considered just asking her to marry me. Mary and I did it a total of 4 times. The last time we got together, I actually sprung for a room. It wasn't much of a departure from the van. In fact, in some ways, it was worse. It was a shitty small motel called the Garden State Motor Lodge that is still there on Route 22 eastbound in Union, a couple of miles before you hit Freelandizen Avenue in Newark. That was where some of the more happening kids in high school took broads to get laid. I was really into this girl, so I splurged. I went for one of their top-tier $18-a-night rooms. This place was one of those establishments where rooms were also available by the hour. I'm pretty sure that's the deal I went for. It paid off, too. My girl gave me the usual, plus a free blowjob. The time before, she also didn't charge me for the blowjob, which was wonderful. It was the kind of treatment that convinced me that we should definitely get married. I mean, how many guys' girlfriends don't charge them for a blowjob on their 4th date? Think about how much it costs just getting to the 4th date. The day after our rendezvous at the Garden State Motor Lodge, I was on cloud 9 and decided to proceed with my plan to introduce her to my family, which was my first step at making this a real, eventually non-payment-based relationship. I was unsure about it, though, because of the profound sadness in our house. My mom was a tower of strength. She was the only thing keeping us all together, and I thought that bringing an attractive girl over so I could tell my mom I had a girlfriend might improve her mood. I've never asked my sister, but I'm pretty sure she didn't lose her virginity to a male whore. She probably went a more conventional route. Oh, wait, my sister, as well as every other girl I'm related to, has never had sex. I've never done anything normally in my entire life, really. I'm a fucked up person, let's face it. Quite frankly, I'm lucky to have any sort of job at all, much less a job working on the coolest radio show ever and making the kind of money I make today. Back then, I already knew that I was fucked up. And I knew that losing my virginity the way I did was fucked up. But I thought that I could turn it around. Even though I wasn't going to school like my sister, I'd at least show my mom that I met a nice girl and might have a shot at getting married and having some kind of normal life. Of course, this story has a sad ending like most fucking things in my life do, particularly when women are involved. About a week later, I called Mary's apartment, and her sister told me that Mary had gone back to Brazil. My heart dropped. I swallowed hard and almost couldn't speak. Really? I said. What happened? Well, she has a boyfriend back there, her sister said. He was going to come over here and then he does not. He knows nothing about what we are doing here, okay? That's really too bad, I said. The sister spoke English pretty well compared to Mary, so she was able to explain their situation. She's not coming back, she said. We are really nice people. We are very religious. We are doing this only to make money so we could get over here, and her boyfriend wants her to go back. But she said you are very nice, and if you want to come by, I will be happy to help you out. Now that's my kind of religious chick. Yeah, maybe we could do that, I said, knowing full well that I had no intention of it. I'll call you. I didn't want to flat out turn her down, but as far as I was concerned, she wasn't even in Mary's league. I remember hoping that things would get better for Mary in her village. But to be honest, it sounded like the best career a woman could land back there was becoming a heroin mule. And now, years later, after all of my struggles with drugs, I'd like to think that possibly I've done some heroin that Sweet Mary shit out at a Best Western in the South Bronx, perhaps at gunpoint. It might sound strange to you, but I guess I'm just a hopeless romantic. I was instantly depressed because those dates with Mary were just about all I had to live for. I ended up calling her sister back the next day. I told her to have Mary call me if she ever returned to the States and gave her my phone number. At that point, I had my own phone line in our house, which rang only in my room. I kept that number for another 10 years and never got a call. It took me a while to get over Mary, and as you can tell, I'll never forget her. More than a few times in the months and years to follow, I'd drive by her apartment complex. I kept thinking each time I passed by that I'd see her back in town, just walking down the street, heading home. In the back of my mind, I never totally believed her sister's story. I thought maybe I'd creeped her out somehow, or that she could see I was getting attached and had her sister make up a story. My self-esteem is always good in a pinch. Nothing can change the fact that I had four wonderful meetings with this girl, and she helped me become a man. And she did it while there was still an een at the end of my age. Thank the Lord for that. Besides, I guarantee that none of my friends lost their virginity to a chick hotter than Mary. She had a nice ass, and she had beautiful thighs. She had real tits that were a solid C-cup, young and perky. She was built just exactly the way I like a chick to be built. In the years to come, one of my favorite bars became a place called McGee's, which later became Suspenders. That isn't far from the Camelot Diner. I spent far too many nights there in my 20s, drinking and getting arrested for drunk and disorderly, for fighting, and also for a DUI. On the nights when no one ended up in jail, my buddies Chico, Shecky, Deej, and I would usually end up at the Camelot eating cheeseburger deluxes, chocolate milks, cheesecakes, and chocolate layer cake well into the night. I never said anything to them, but I was usually sitting there wishing Mary would walk in. In my drunker moments, I'd daydream it. She'd stroll through the door, looking every inch as hot as she was. We'd go out into the parking lot, and then I'd say to her, much like Abe Vigoda said to Robert Duvall in The Godfather, "Mary, could you throw me one for old time's sake?" And much like Duvall said to him, she'd say, "Can't do it, Artie." Well, that never happened. Instead, I spent many of those nights fending off questions from my friends about how I lost my virginity. I was always so vague that I'm not sure even I remember the bullshit story I used. I think it went something like this. So yeah, it was the summer of 85 and I was down the shore one weekend. This chick was a friend of a friend. I can't even remember what high school she went to. But it was just that one weekend, and then she never called me. Yeah, that sounds about right. I was so embarrassed about the story, even 10 years later, that I still couldn't admit it. It's not like my friends hadn't done dumb shit. I certainly could have told my buddy Deej. He's the only other guy who went to my high school and wanted to get into show business. We got real tight in our late teens and 20s by walking that road together. We went on auditions and took acting classes in Greenwich Village for the few weeks we could afford to. We had a bond, because to do that at all, we had to be able to embarrass ourselves in front of each other all the time. Deej is a great guy, he would have understood, but for some reason I could never get up the balls to share it. Even though for years I was dying to tell someone this story. As for my squiring skills, after Mary, I went into a big drought. I thought that all I needed to do was lose my virginity and then I'd just be having sex all the time, forever. I figured that once I'd done it, I'd have some kind of natural sex knowledge that broads would sense. I wouldn't act any different, but I'd have an invisible manly swagger as a non-virgin that would make me irresistible. I think it's what's affectionately known as having stank on your down low. That didn't happen, but about a year later I went on a ski trip against my will. Skiing just ain't my thing. Let me put it to you this way. For years my manager tried to get me to do the Aspen Comedy Festival, and I told him that the two groups of people I hate most in this world are comedians and people who ski. So it sounded like a living hell. I do not ski, nor will I ever. But this one time I got talked into it by my buddy Al, his girlfriend Toby, and Deej, just as a way to get the fuck out of town. We drove up to a place called Owl's Nest in Ontario, Canada, where I spent my time drinking in the lodge. And that's where I met the second girl I ever had sex with. I got her drunk one night on Absolute Vodka, and I made Deej spend the night in Al and Toby's room. I won't name names, but my buddies definitely remember her, because that story has never really gone out of rotation. Mostly because on the drive home, we were trying to figure out who the girl looked like. An hour into it, I had it. She looked exactly like Elton John. To this day, if anything about Canada or skiing is mentioned, one of my friends will start singing, "It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside." There was one remarkable thing about that experience. The girl was a virgin. She was the only virgin I've ever slept with. I do see something humorous in the fact that my virginity was taken by a complete pro, and the next time I had sex, I played that role, just not nearly as well. As far as my sexual history goes, I didn't start putting up any real numbers until I began going into New York City to try my luck doing stand-up. Once I was involved in the New York scene and doing coke and hitting after-hours clubs, it became much easier. Anyone who was or is involved in that scene knows it's a no-brainer. You meet broads and you have cocaine relationships, which revolve around doing lots of cocaine and then fucking. Those are never a sure thing, however, because usually girls who want to hang with you for coke love coke way more than they love fucking. In my struggling years in New York, I probably put up another 7 or 8 broads, which for me are strong numbers because I have never been a ladies' man. However bold I may be when I'm on stage or making a fool of myself for laughs, it goes right out the window in the presence of a beautiful woman. And time and success have done nothing at all to change that. I'm still unbelievably shy around women. It's the classic scenario. As a performer, I'm more comfortable on stage in front of 5,000 people than one-on-one with a hot chick. When I got my role on Mad TV in the summer of 1995, I was 27 years old. My number at that point was 11. Only 2 of them were repeat customers, 3 of them if you include Mary the hooker. I had only 3 repeats. I would like to have said 3-peats, but I didn't want to have to pay Pat Riley a licensing fee. But by that point, I had been to a lot of bachelor parties, so I'd been blown by about 50 different women. I'm sure many of my fans will be disappointed to hear that of the 11 I had sex with, only 2 were whores, which makes that 9 regular chicks I was able to talk into bed. I did find out when I moved to L.A., however, that if you're a regular on a network show, you can be the world's biggest retard and still get laid. And that's a good thing for me, for obvious reasons. Still, my numbers should be much better. At the age of 40, 13 years into show business, I have somehow moved up the ladder into the major leagues of entertainment, but my numbers haven't really jumped accordingly. I went from doing stand-up to a network show, to having a network deal, to being in studio movies, and then to a regular spot on the biggest radio show ever. When we talked about numbers again recently on the air, I was vague about it, because for the first time in my life, I actually couldn't remember. I secretly felt so cool that I had actually lost count of how many chicks I banged. I tried my best to add it all up tonight, and I'd say I'm up to around 80. If I'd never gotten into show business, of course, I'd probably still be lingering down around 11. But now that I'm thinking about it, 80 is a really low number considering the career I've had. I've spent the last 7 years doing the Howard Stern Show, and that is the ultimate, the best regular gig a comedian can have. Doing Howard, plus all the stand-up I do, I've seen every kind of groupie, because a headlining comedian in a good club can get sex, drugs, anything. I figured that a guy who was at all good with women and had my same career for the past 13 years would be up over 1,000, while 80 might be a lot for a normal guy. Remember that we're talking about 80 put up by a guy who in his 40s still sucks with women, and is in a line of work where it's easy to get broads. It's much more realistically pathetic when you see it that way, don't you think? Ladies and gentlemen out there in Bookland, this is Artie Lang, and I'd like to talk to you about that certain time that comes up in every professional's life, especially an entertainer, that time that we've all had to face in our careers, and of course I'm talking about the time to simply give up. I was trying to read this entire book, and I couldn't do it because of what I told the people here was sweat from being sick. It was clearly withdrawals from heroin. I was sweating to death and ruining the headsets and John Marshall sound, and I was afraid of spreading some sort of crazy disease. And instead of cleaning up and finishing the rest of the book, I did what I've done so many times before in my life. I simply gave up. I am the direct opposite of what Derek Jeter would want from a kid. Will Smith always says, don't let anybody ever tell you you can't do something. Never give up. Well, I don't think that's realistic. I was told by my family to give up, and I did. And if they didn't tell me that, I'd still be trying to play shortstop for the Yankees, and it would be weird, quite frankly. I'd be down in Tampa like this 40-year-old drunk guy with a uniform on that he bought at Target, trying to get in batting practice and play shortstop. But instead, my family, being realistic and a good family, said, listen, you'll never play shortstop for the Yankees. This is ridiculous. You're heavy set. You're not that coordinated. You're sort of stupid. You will never play for the Yankees. Give up. Do something else. You have to give up. You're an idiot, and you're embarrassing us. And that was good advice. I think they could have waited till after my 9th birthday, but I think that was good advice. So, with this audiobook, 6 chapters in, as you'll see, I gave up, and I called, other people to finish it for me. And I paid them way, way low figures as far as the book world is concerned. I ripped off my friends, and they finished the book for me because I'm an unrecovering drug addict. I chose the only three people that I could think of to finish a book. Jimmy Florentine, an inarticulate Jersey comic with a annoying voice. Gary Delabate, a man who I love, but whose teeth gets in the way of everything he says. And my other friend, who can't read. Enjoy myself, Jim Florentine, Gary Bababui Delabate, and the Reverend Bob Levy, the only Jewish guy who cannot read, and we'll read this book to you, okay? I'm just explaining why I'm not reading the whole thing, and my fans are used to me giving up, and what can I tell you? See you on the road at some shitty hotel. Bye.
Too Fat to Fish. My days as a longshoreman. I grew up with about 52 guys named Mike, so pretty early on, each of them was given a nickname to tell them all apart. Checky, Joker, Deeg, Dutt, and Goof, to name a few. Of all those illustrious nicknamed Mikes, Goof plays a major role in the story. At the time of my father's death, I was 22 years old, unemployed, and I owed bookies and Shylocks money. I was a drunk who started doing drugs a little too much and gambled with money I didn't have. All I hope is that there's an afterlife, so my father can see that the son who was such a fuck-up when he died went on to make something of himself. But at the time of this story, that was a long way off. By 1990, a bunch of my friends had gone through college and were ready to graduate. I'd done nothing for those 4 years except try stand-up twice with miserable results and take one acting class in Greenwich Village with my buddy. I couldn't stay enrolled in it for very long because I didn't have enough money, so all I'd really done was get a 4-year degree in vegetating. While Pop was alive, time stood still for us, but once he was gone, it was like I woke up and realized that the world had been passing me by. His death lit a fire under my ass, so about a month after he died, I saw an ad in the paper and went to a club in Greenwich Village that was having a stand-up comedy contest sponsored by a radio station on Long Island. I was one of 10 contestants, and it was officially the third time I ever did stand-up. 3 years had gone by since I last tried it, and I'd done so badly that it took me that long to forget it. But I just said, fuck it, for my father I'll try it again. I came in sixth place, which wasn't great, but at least there were four people in the world shittier at it than I was. It was incentive enough to try it again. I also decided to get myself a job of some kind, and Goof was there for me. He asked his father to give me a job in the machine shop he owned in Roselle, New Jersey. The only opening I could fill was sweeping up, doing basic machine work, drilling stuff, working on a lift, and loading and unloading this powder that is used to sandblast stuff on major industrial construction jobs. Goof's dad had a side business where he would buy all the sandblasting powder in bulk, then package it up in huge buckets and secure it to pallets that were sold and loaded onto trucks. Part of my job was sweeping up around that operation. I started 2 days after my father's memorial mass and got $6 an hour under the table. That sparked exactly 1 year of absolute nothingness. Just a shit-awful loser bullshit year in my life. I worked at that job for $6 an hour, and I could get there whatever time I wanted as long as I finished all the work I had for the day. Here's how my typical workday went. I would get there at noon, do my work, and be finished by about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. A lot of nights, Goof would come over from the machine area and help me finish up so we could get out of there quicker and start our night of drinking. For dinner, we'd order a bacon pizza from Domino's and bring it back to the area where all the sand was stored. I will never forget all the bacon pizzas we consumed that year because each and every one ended up being coated in that disgusting sand, which seemed to settle evenly over the top of the bacon and cheese the second we'd open the box. God knows what was in that shit, because it actually changed the color of the pizza from a healthy white and red to this toxic shade of magenta. I've never seen that color anywhere else in the natural world. Between that, the 8-packs of Marlboro Reds I was smoking a day, and the old granddad or Jim Beam I bring to work to get loaded, I probably took 10 years off my life in that 1 year alone. On a good week, I'd make probably about $250, cash, almost all of which I spent at local bars around the Union area. One of them was this place where the bartender would give us free drinks all night. He started serving us when we were like 15, and he just didn't care. He was running a racket and a half in there. Every single buddy of his who came in drank for free, and he pocketed all the tips directly. The bar was always crowded, but the owner couldn't figure out why he was barely breaking even. A real whiz with numbers, that guy. We'd also go to the sports bar and drink ourselves into oblivion. We'd do blow whenever it was around, and I'd gamble with money that I didn't have. I did have the distinction, however, of being the first one of my friends to put in a 100-timer gambling. The smallest bet a bookie takes is called a time. That is not to be confused with a dime, which is a bet for $1,000. 50 dimes and 50 times are very different things. Dimes are for high rollers, and times are for people who are not high rollers, like me and my friends. In our world, though, if you bet 20 times, you were a high roller, because that's a $100 bet. $100 to us was a hell of a lot to put on the line. There was also a VIG you had to pay the bookie if you lost, which was a $1 charge per $5 time. So if you lost $100, you really lost $110. A VIG is like a tax for losing that basically gives the bookie and the Shylock an advantage, meaning they will probably always be in the money, even if more people win than lose that week. VIGs only counted on bets of $50 or more at a rate of $5 per 50 lost. Everyone knew that if you bet less than $50, you were a fucking pussy anyway, and they felt too sorry for your loser ass to charge you a VIG. During this period, my buddies and I got a number for a bookie on Staten Island whose name was Bobo, and we bet on and off with him for like 8 years, until one day he just disappeared. The number didn't work and no one knew what happened. But before Bobo fell off the face of the earth, I became the first of my friends to bet a 100-timer, and I bet it with Bobo. It was a 10-buck VIG for every 100 bucks you bet, so a 100-timer would be betting $500. If I lost, I'd owe $550, and if I won, I'd win $500. None of my friends had come anywhere close to that. Considering that I had about $80 to my name, they couldn't believe what I was doing. Bobo took the bet, which I had to place through a couple of our friends, who acted as middlemen for all the bets we placed. Bobo would send a guy down from Staten Island to take the bets and collect or pay out each week, and they'd meet him at the McDonald's parking lot on the parkway in Union. Our friends never actually met Bobo. No one we knew had ever seen him. They only dealt with Bobo's guy. The game I bet on was the Giants versus the 49ers in about week 10 of the season on Monday Night Football. Obviously, I thought I had a sure win on my hands, but this was both the year that my judgment was about as clear as my vision after a bottle of Jack Daniels, and the season when the Giants overachieved and beat the 49ers in the NFC Championship before beating the Bills in the Super Bowl. Bobo's line on this regular season Monday night game was the 49ers giving 3.5 points to the Giants. Now, some lines had them giving 4, and the New York Post and the Daily News had them giving 4.5, but Bobo's line was 3.5. I've always liked the Giants, and they were playing out in San Francisco, so I said, fuck it. The Giants will definitely cover 3.5 points. To anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about, it meant that if the Giants won outright and you bet the Giants, you won. And if they lost, but only by 3 points, you won dough too, since the points given was 3.5. If they lost by more than 3.5 points, then you lost your money and you paid the VIG. All the Giants had to do was not lose by more than 3.5 points for me to collect. We watched the game at a bar, and in a shining example of my shitty luck that year, it turned out to be a grueling defensive battle that the Giants lost 7-3. And you know what? I blame Joe Montana. That motherfucker is responsible for me losing more fucking money in my life, that fucking asswipe. I cannot stand watching him interviewed, even today. Fuck him. So anyway, I lost $550 and I had only $80, and what unfolded next has become a classic story among my friends. I was in that state of mind that people who have been on the skids know well. It's when you just don't give a fuck at all and you handle situations that you should be taking more seriously as if they're a joke because you really don't care what happens to you. When you feel that way, you're actually hoping for something or someone to make a decision for you because you don't give a shit about doing anything for yourself. My nonchalance worried my friend who had to meet Bobo's guy. Artie, what the fuck am I going to tell this guy? He said. Tell him I don't have the money. It's not like you'll be lying, I said. Are you serious? Yeah. Can't I work it off or something? I was acting like Bobo had a restaurant, and I could just do dishes for a few weeks to cover my dinner tab. It wasn't too far from the truth in the end. The middleman who represented Bobo each week actually had a roofing business, and when he met my friend, he came up with a solution. Yeah, tell your dumb fuck friend Artie that I'm working 2 6-day weeks up at this place in Clifton, he said. I'll give that jerk off $250 each week, and he can work it off. I accepted and spent 2 weeks roofing with this fucking guy up in Clifton. In really shitty late fall weather. It was glamorous work, climbing my ass up and down a ladder on a roof with a steep pitch, carrying these enormous fucking bags of shingles. 6 days each week, I worked a 14-hour day. I was expecting $250 a week, so I'd be even after 2 weeks, but when I shook his hand that last day, he told me otherwise. Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate it, I said. We're even, right? Even, he said. The fuck are you talking about, jerkoff? You still owe Bobo the $50 VIG. That was the kind of prick I was dealing with. I don't know who I borrowed it from, but I came up with the $50 VIG, and then I was even. And then, in one of my rare rational decisions from that period, I actually stopped gambling for a while. I think I made it through to the playoffs before trying my hand again. In the meantime, I lived vicariously through a few of my friends who tried to get one over on Bobo by betting on hockey games. These geniuses figured out that the NHL held one day game a week, on Wednesday afternoons, while every other game of the season was played at night. Bobo didn't pay much attention to hockey, so one time, for a goof, they bet with his middleman on a game that had already happened. With Bobo, you had to call all of your bets in by 7 p.m. So they watched the game that afternoon and bet on the winner because there was an outside shot that Bobo would think the game was on for Wednesday night. Sure enough, Bobo looked at the scores the next day, not knowing about the day game thing, saw that they'd won, and he paid him out. That was it. They were in on a sure thing. As long as they didn't arouse suspicion, they could probably keep it going for a while. But that wasn't enough for these guys. They wanted to win big. They put one over on him once, so they thought they were the shit and started betting on that Wednesday afternoon hockey game every week, well into the spring, each time for more money. Soon, like classic shitheads, they bet one-timer bets on every other game, but on those Wednesday games, they'd bet enormous fucking amounts. If they had any brains at all, they would have bet a steady number on those Wednesday games, and the guy never would have noticed. But they couldn't do that. They'd bet $200 a game when a 40-timer was a huge thing. It doesn't say much about Bobo's accounting department that it took them about 5 or 6 weeks to notice that these two Gavones were winning like 60-time parlays, which means that not only were they betting the team that won, they were also betting the over and under in the game, which is the point spread. A parlay means the two bets are connected, so unless you win both, you lose all the money. These are what we call long shots, and these guys hit 5 of them in a row, which is what we call astonishing and nearly impossible. So Bobo's crack team of bookies started to wonder what the hell was going on with these kids and if they knew somebody playing in the hockey game every Wednesday night. Bobo decided to do a little homework, so he picked up the paper and he realized that these two smartest kids from Jersey had been duping him for the last 2 or 3 months, betting on games that had already happened. Even though they were betting well above their means, we were all pretty small time, so they'd probably only taken him for about $800. Anyway, Bobo wasn't happy, and his middleman called our friend to deliver the message. Listen, motherfucker, he said. Your buddy's fucked up and they won again this week. They are not getting that money, and Bobo wants the money they ripped him off for. Bobo is fucking livid. Your dumb fuck buddies are going to meet Bobo himself, not me, at that fucking McDonald's this week, you hear me? They don't show up, you're all fucking dead. I got nothing to do with this, our friend said. I didn't rip him off. Bobo don't fucking care, you hear me? You're all answering for this, asshole. Go to the back of the McDonald's, the booth on the left-hand side. Okay, my friend said, pretty worried. How am I going to know who he is? He's 50, bald with tattoos. Fucking be there. The guy hung up. My friend, the middleman, and my friends, the hockey bettors, were scared shitless. There was no way they were going to meet Bobo. My friend who got the call had to go, so I went with him, even though we weren't the assholes ripping him off. It didn't matter to Bobo. We were all getting punished that week. He didn't pay anything the rest of us had won, plus we were getting a talking to. My friend and I went down to the McDonald's at the usual time, went into the back, and saw a guy who matched the description. Our hearts were pounding as we walked over to him. He told us to sit down. He was sitting there with a quarter pounder with cheese and an order of large fries in front of him. You want a fry, kid? He asked me. Yeah, sure, I said, and I took one. I thought that was very nice of him. We sat there in awkward silence as Bobo looked down in concentration, refusing to make eye contact with us for about 2 minutes. Then he looked up. You two motherfuckers tell your fucking friends something from me, he said real low, leaning forward and staring us in the eye. If they ever try something like this again, I will find out where they live and I will fucking kill their parents. If they got kids, I will fucking kill their kids in front of them. I will make them fucking watch and then I will tear their fucking hearts out. He started yelling real loud and got a bit red in the face. I will rape their fucking grandmothers, you hear me? I am not here to be made a fucking fool of. I will hit them with a bat as hard as I can in their fucking face. My friend and I were kind of looking down out of respect for Bobo as he went on threatening to rape and kill people. But then both of us looked up at him, then at each other, and just started hysterically laughing. It was Ash Wednesday, and Bobo, being a good Catholic, was sitting there with an enormous ash cross on his forehead, threatening to murder our unborn children and behead our deceased relatives. He'd obviously gone to church, got his ashes, and didn't stop to think just how ridiculous he would look screaming at us with a cross on his forehead. We didn't know what to do because there was no way we were going to stop laughing. We had that uncontrollable laughter that nerves and ludicrous situations bring on. All we could do was put our heads down and hope that Bobo would think we were trembling with fear instead of shaking in hysterics. But we were no longer looking at him, and he was getting really pissed. He started shouting louder and louder, and his face got redder and redder, which made that enormous black ash cross look even funnier. "You motherfuckers better show me some respect," he screamed. "You're not getting a fucking cent of the money I owe you this week. You tell those motherfuckers to get me my money, or I'll kill them and I'll kill their family. Now get the fuck out of here. Get out of my sight." We got up and made it to the door, but as soon as we were in the parking lot, we burst out laughing harder than we had before. We could barely move. We had to lie on the hood of my 1970 Chevy Nova for about an hour laughing. "I don't even think he knew it was there," my friend said. "His wife probably told him when he left this morning, 'Make sure you get ashes, Bobo. It's Ash Wednesday today,' I said. 'And bring home some soda bread.' I'm sure he was like, 'Okay, honey, I'll get the ashes. Then I have to go threaten to rape and kill a couple of kids' families over in Jersey. Then I'll pick up the bread. See you tonight.'" And Bobo's Ash Wednesday cross was just enormous. It was as big as the cross that Jesus climbed up the fucking mountain with. That was the pinnacle of 1990, that year of shit for me. Then in February 1991, a friend told me that he put in a word for me with his father, since he knew the job in the machine shop with Goof was a dead end. All my friends knew that I'd tried stand-up again, but nothing much was happening with that, so I needed a good job. He told me that his dad had openings for longshoreman jobs down at Port Newark, and everyone who knows anything about that knows that those jobs aren't exactly advertised in the paper. You have to know somebody because they are positions coveted by any guy who has no college degree. If you get one, you're set. The union is so amazing that you're taken care of for life. My buddy's father was very respected in the union. He got Port Newark and Elizabeth running really well in his years in office. It was no longer the way it was in the old days of On the Waterfront with Brando and Johnny Friendly. Nobody ripped off anybody anymore, and the union insisted on honest, cooperative relationships with management. Somewhere along the line, they figured out that in the long run, it was better for their guys to keep the peace instead of stealing a piece of everything that came through there. Since my friend's dad was putting in a word for me, I was able to go down and start working part-time just by showing up and saying that he'd sent me. He had that kind of standing in the union. I'd be able to work my way up, and when a permanent position opened up, I'd be in there for life. At the time, the part-time rate was $19 an hour, and there was always a lot of overtime. You could get time and a half for a while, and then double time kicked in. There were guys down there who could not spell their fucking names who were making $100,000 a year with overtime. I got a position at the orange juice pier where ships came in from Brazil and unloaded liquid orange juice concentrate. When a ship came into the port, it took 3 hours to tie it up and hook up huge hoses through which 3 million gallons of orange juice concentrate would flow into refrigerated tanks. It took about 4 days for all of the orange juice to be pumped out, and according to union law, 4 longshoremen were required to be there the whole time to supervise the operation. For those 4 days, you slept there, and you were on the clock, being paid 24/7. To pass time, the tradition was that you played cards. I would play 500 rummy, and I tried to learn how to play pinochle with Chick, the old-time Italian longshoreman who enjoyed whipping my fucking ass. Chick was as good as a professional card player, and a prick about it, too. You'd play 500 rummy with this guy, and he would let you get up 400, almost 500, before he'd methodically take your heart out with his hands. He'd let you get like 10 points from victory, then beat you and leave you owing him money. Chick had also played speed chess, which was fine with me because he really enjoyed kicking this management guy's ass all the time, and the rest of us really enjoyed watching it. This guy was an engineer who graduated from Yale, and Chick would take him for $200 a week. The guy kept coming back, thinking he was going to get one over on this old Italian guy, but he never did. It killed the guy that Chick, who probably barely made it to 7th grade, was beating him every single day on his lunch hour. Every day on the way to work, Chick listened to CBS FM in his Lincoln Continental as he made the 5-minute drive from the down next section of Newark where he lived to the port. He'd listen to the famous Harry Harrison in the Morning Show and absorb whatever oldies they were playing. Since Chick worked right next to me putting lids on the huge drums of orange juice concentrate, I'd hear him for the entire morning sing whatever song it was that he just heard in his car on CBS FM. If the song didn't interest him, or if he wanted to break it up a little, he'd do a jingle that he made up about Harry Harrison. He'd do all of this at the top of his lungs. For 4 hours, since he always added curses to whatever he sang, he would belt out things like this. "Kathy's clown, Kathy's motherfucking clown. Hey Jude, hey fucking Judy, fucking Judy, fucking Judy, hey fucking Judy, cocksucking na na na, Nah, 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 fucking Jude. But my favorites were the jingles. Harry Harrison, Harry fucking faggot Harrison, in the cocksucking morning. You had to find a way to enjoy it because no one was telling Chick to stop. He ran the place. Every morning, lunch trucks would come at around 10:30, loaded up with potatoes and egg sandwiches or peppers and egg sandwiches, and Chick would buy everybody a first break snack. You try to give him $5 for your sandwich and he'd get truly offended, like close to violence offended. Get the fuck out of here with your $5, he shouted at me. You think your piece of shit $5 is going to make me rich? Fucking eat the sandwich. Since I was a low guy on the totem pole, he'd usually ask me to go get the lunch. There was an Irish kid who worked with us who would order potato and egg sandwiches with ketchup on it, which is like sacrilegious to Italians. It's the same as putting cheese on linguine with clams. You just don't do it. I didn't feel good about it, but I ordered it for the guy anyway. The owner of the truck was this Italian guy, and when I put the order for ketchup, he stopped what he was doing and he looked at me like I just told him to go fuck his mother. I do not do ketchup, he said. Listen, I know it's not for me, I said. The guy's Irish who wants it. He doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. He asked for ketchup. Fuck him. I do not do ketchup. Man, come on, just give me a couple of ketchup packets. I gotta bring everyone lunch. I will give you no ketchup. Not on my sandwich. You are not going to ruin that fucking sandwich. Are you really going to make me go somewhere else for ketchup packets? No, he said, staring me down. I do not want to hear about you or anyone else putting fucking ketchup on my sandwiches. I will not enable you to do that. Fuck that. You get no ketchup from me. Every day I would have to go to the fucking diner down the street, buy a cup of coffee, and ask for ketchup packets. It took me an extra 20 minutes, all because this fucking Irish guy who had no idea how to properly eat an Italian potatoes and egg sandwich had to have ketchup on it. There was another character down there, unlike anyone I've ever met, who we'll call Tony D, who was always butting heads with the management people. He was an older guy who liked busting all the younger guys' chops about broads and whatever else came to mind. We were split up into two teams. I was part of the crew that loaded those huge 50-gallon drums with orange juice. The other crew loaded and unloaded trucks. Tony was on the truck side of the operation. Whenever our break ended, Tony would still be on our side of things talking shit. So one of the management guys, all of whom were these nerdy Ivy League types in white coats, would have to walk over to him and timidly say, Tony, you've got to get back to work on your side now. Tony D loved this. He waited for it, each and every break. He'd get right up in their face, half kidding and half serious, just to fuck with them. I'm breaking balls here. You telling me I can't break balls, he'd say? That'll be the fucking day when I can't break balls. Fuck you! At this point, he'd turn away, too angry to go on. He'd actually turn toward us, give us a wink, leaving the management guy to kind of whimper away, looking like he's going to cry. I became close friends with a few of the guys I worked with down there, one of whom was a senior longshoreman. This guy was basically the foreman of the group and essentially my boss. One Friday night at the end of work, he asked me if I wanted to go fishing with him the next day. Now, I had never gone fishing and didn't really give a shit about learning how to fish, but he was a good guy, not to mention that he was my boss, and I wanted to get in good with him. I told him sure, and he said he'd pick me up at 5:30 the next morning. We'd launch his boat from Elizabeth, and we'd go fishing for bluefish and tuna. Like I said, fishing was just not the kind of thing I did, and having never done it before, I agreed to it without giving it much thought. With the same lack of thought, I then went to happy hour with the guys from work like I did every Friday and started to get ossified drunk. In those years, I really took Friday happy hour to heart. I would get so drunk that more than once I bet twice on the same game. I did it this night too. At 5:30, after a few drinks, I called my bookie to bet on a game. Then at 7:30, just before he stopped taking bets, I called him back and bet on the same game, but this time I bet on the opposite team. Now, the only thing that could possibly happen, given that the guy took both my bets, was that I would lose. I was basically giving him the vig. It would have made more sense for me to just call the guy and tell him I'd like to give him $50. I did it three separate times that year, all of them during Friday night happy hours, which should give you an idea how much drinking went on. Wait, what did I do? I asked him the next morning after that third time. You called me at 5:30 and bet on one team, then you called back at 7:30 and bet on the other team, the guy said matter-of-factly. Can I ask you why you let me do that? I said, annoyed. You know I forget shit when I'm drunk. You should have reminded me that I'd already placed a bet. I'm trying to teach you a lesson about drinking and gambling, he said. They don't mix. Wait a second. Am I getting a life lesson from a bookie? I feel like I'm at the end of an episode of Different Strokes. You gotta learn, man, he said. Only way to learn not to be a dumb fuck is the hard way. Listen, buddy, do me a favor. From now on, don't teach me life lessons. Just tell me I'm drunk and that I've already bet and then hang up on me. Drinking was definitely the thing after work on Fridays, mostly at a couple of bars right there in Newark. This place Zip Zip, or Tony DeCanica's, which had great Zuba Depeche. We lived pretty large all around. We got an hour and 15 minutes for lunch every day, which was another great union perk. And sometimes we'd go, all a mess in our work clothes, to these formal restaurants. There was a Spanish tavern, Iberia, and a few great Portuguese and Italian places. We would eat like kings, with waiters in tuxedos serving us. Then we'd go back to work at the port. My favorite lunch down there, though, was this amazing deli called Amelia's, run by this little old Sicilian lady. Amelia made a different special every day, and every once in a while she'd make a big vat of broccoli rabe, and the special would be a sandwich of broccoli rabe with fresh mozzarella on amazing bread from Napadano's, this great old bakery down the street. Then we'd walk across the street to Nasto's, this chocolate factory in the middle of Down Neck, Newark, and get this huge ice cream sundae. After a lunch like that, let me tell you, the last thing you'd want to do is fucking work, let alone put your tool belt on over your fucking gut. All you're really qualified to do after a lunch like that is sleep for 20 hours. There was another little home cooking place we liked too, called Cookies. It was run by a 350-pound Italian woman whose sons were part-time bookies who never worked. Cookie had turned the basement of her home into a little restaurant, probably to support them, and every morning she'd fry 200 meatballs and a bunch of green peppers in oil. When I first started working at the port, I didn't have a driver's license because I lost it after being busted on a DUI charge. So my foreman, the same senior longshoreman who invited me fishing, would drive me to work. Every morning we'd stop off at Cookies so he could put in a bet or pay off or collect from one of her sons, and soon enough, I started doing the same thing. We'd stop over there at like 7:30 in the morning, since we had to be at work by 8, and if we got to her place at the right time, she'd be coming out of the kitchen with 200 freshly fried meatballs and peppers, and she would say, "Help yourself." It smelled so good that I'd start grabbing meatballs with one hand and putting them on a plate while forking into the peppers with my other hand. I'd end up, for breakfast, eating about 10 of these things with 5 helpings of peppers, about 3 pieces of bread, and a soda or root beer to wash it all down. These were not some kind of gay turkey meatballs like you see these days, by the way. They were unbelievably beautiful, real meatballs made of beef and veal. It was the breakfast of champions, and the best way to warm up for my hour and 15-minute lunch. Anyway, the night before this fishing trip, I was out with all the guys and my foreman, and by 10 p.m. I was stone drunk off my ass. I'd done a little blow that night too, since there was some going around, so I was nowhere close to getting a good night's sleep before the big adventure. That's not what I told the foreman, though. When he came up to me, slapped me on the shoulder, said goodbye, and told me he'd be over to pick me up bright and early at 5:30 a.m., I couldn't have been more enthusiastic. "Dude," I said, "I'll be ready. It's going to be great." All night long, I had talked up how much I was ready for it and looking forward to it, assuring him that I was really into fishing. I ended up going out to a go-go bar in Linden, New Jersey called Cheeks, with my friends Chico and Checky and another one of the many Mikes. I did not get home until 3 or 3:30 a.m., and when I did, I was drunk, high, and covered in cheap lipstick from the many dancers I had paid to kiss me on the cheek. I passed the fuck out in all my clothes, and by the time 5:30 came around, I'd barely gotten a nap and was nowhere close to being sober. I was lying there like a Neanderthal, sweating like a pig, with puffy eyes, my hair all over my face, and my mouth wide open. The phone must have rung for a few minutes before it woke me up, but when it did, it scared the shit out of me. At first, I had no idea where I was. Then I picked up the phone. "You ready to go fishing?" my boss said. "It's 5:30. I'm on my way over." If it had been anyone else in the entire world but my boss, I would have told the guy to go fuck off and slept all day. But somewhere in the haze clogging my brain, I remembered the drunken promise I'd made the night before. I cleared my throat, got one eye all the way open, and hoped I sounded more tired than drunk. "Oh yeah, come on over," I said. "I overslept, but I'm ready." "All right, move your ass. I'll be there in 20 minutes. I got up, tried to see through my skull-splitting headache, and made it to the shower. I kind of stood there under the water for a few minutes. Then I threw on some sweatpants, brushed my teeth, and took a look in the mirror. It wasn't good at all. I looked like George Clinton when he got busted for crack. The shower hadn't come close to washing away the reek of liquor, and I had the worst bedhead I'd ever seen on someone who wasn't homeless. For a minute, I wondered if shaving might improve things. "Fuck it," I said, and I walked downstairs. Now, because my mother is both a crazy person and an insanely clean Italian woman, she was already up at 5:30 a.m. on Saturday vacuuming. As a working woman, my mother never got the chance to vacuum during the week and always had a full schedule of things to get done over the weekend, so she would get up at the crack of dawn on Saturday mornings and start cleaning. It was another reason that I liked to get passed out drunk on Friday nights, so I could sleep through the noise. I snuck downstairs knowing full well that there was no way I was going to make it out of the house on her watch. She had her back to me as I came down the stairs, but she seemed to sense me coming. It wasn't any kind of mother's intuition. Given my condition, it was probably just her sense of smell. She's one of those weird people who hate the smell of tequila, sweat, and stale orange juice. She took one look at me, death warmed over, stopped the vacuum, and stared me down for like a full minute. "Where are you going?" she asked. She looked at me with the utmost suspicion, like I was an intruder in her home. She probably thought I was sneaking out to buy drugs. "I'm going fishing, Ma," I said. "What?" she said, crossing her arms. "What are you doing?" "I'm going fishing, Ma. I got invited by my foreman at the job." "No, you are not, Artie," she said, now glaring at me. "You are not going fishing." "What do you mean I'm not going fishing?" I said. "I got invited fishing. I'm going fishing." I'd like to remind you that I was 23 years old, and until this point, not only had I never gone fishing, I'd never even shown an interest in anything that could be considered a hobby besides playing baseball, busting chops, drinking, and doing drugs. "Artie, you are not going fishing." Panic was creeping into her voice. At the time, I was somewhat heavy, definitely heavier than I was in high school, but svelte compared to how I am now. Still, to my mother, I was much too heavy and out of shape to do anything physical. Fishing isn't exactly running a 5K, but the water, in her mind, spelled certain death for her son. I could see her wheels spinning, thinking of what she could say to keep me from going. "You listen to me, Artie," she said, working herself into a yell that could strip paint from the walls. "You are not going fishing. You are not leaving this house. You are too fat to fish. Do you hear me? You are too fat to fish." Something clicked in my mind. Maybe it was just seeing me looking like that much of a mess, wondering what the hell I was doing to myself at night. Or maybe it was a fear of losing me after losing my father. Whatever it was to her in that moment, allowing me to go fishing was like allowing me to walk off a cliff. "Ma, it's my boss. I've got to go." I tried to reason with her. "He's going to be here in like 5 minutes. I got to get in good with this guy." "I don't give a shit, Artie. You can't swim. You don't like water. You are too fat to fish. I have never seen you do a thing. You have no interest. You have no hobbies. You aren't interested in anything but fooling around. You are not leaving this house. You will drown and die. You are too fat to fish." "Ma, I can swim." "No, you can't." "Ma, you see me swim," I yelled. "I swim every year in the ocean down at the shore." "I don't care, Artie. You are fat. You will die." She kept on like that for half an hour straight, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. "You are going to fall out of that boat and you will drown. Is there even a motor on this boat?" "I don't know, Ma." "You don't know? And you plan on going fishing on that boat? You don't even know how to fish. Tell me, what are you going to catch, Artie?" "I don't know, Ma. Tuna and bluefish?" "No, you won't. You will catch nothing. Because you're not going. Because you're too fat to fish." Whatever other points my mother made about why my plan was so outrageous, she kept returning to the fact that I was too fat to fish. It was like the chorus to an insane song she was singing. She got so worked up and loud that my sister, Stacy, woke up and lay in her bed hysterically laughing. She got so loud that my next-door neighbors woke up and started laughing because all of our windows were open. She just kept screaming the phrase, "too fat to fish." This was a battle that I was not going to win, so I called my foreman and luckily caught him right before he left his house. "Hey, man," I said. "I'm leaving now. What's up?" "Well, I can't go," I said. "This is real embarrassing, but my mother will not let me go fishing with you today." "Come on, fuck you," he started laughing. "That's a good one. I'll be right over." "No, I'm serious, man. She won't let me go." "What are you, 5 years old? You need a note from your ma, Artie?" "Come on, man. You're Italian. You know how Italian mothers can get." He got quiet for a minute. "She's really not letting you go?" When I put it that way, the guy understood what I was saying, but for good measure, I put my mother on the phone. "Artie is not going fishing today. He's not going anywhere in a boat with you because he's too fat to fish and will fall out of the boat. But go have a nice time." Luckily, my mother wasn't the type to embarrass me. I went upstairs, my hangover now infinitely worse after all that yelling, and ran into Stacy, who was about to piss herself laughing. "Do you realize that she screamed at you for like 40 minutes, she said, doubled over. "What the hell was that? People heard her down the block." "Yeah, I know." I passed out again in my clothes and slept until about 3 p.m., and when I woke up, my mother made me a mozzarella omelet, and I ate it, and I was never happier in my life. Then I went back to sleep. That night, over dinner, my sister started laughing again. "Ma, do you realize what you sounded like this morning?" Stacy asked. I ran into the neighbors, and they heard the whole thing and were asking me about it. "You just kept screaming that